As a leader of the civil rights movement, John Lewis, the son of Alabama sharecroppers, was repeatedly insulted, beaten, and jailed, but he never lost faith in the movement's nonviolent tactics, even after his close friends, Martin Luther King Jr. and Bobby Kennedy, were assassinated in 1968. Mr. Lewis has been a Democratic congressman from Georgia since 1987. In his new book, Across That Bridge, Life Lessons and a Vision for Change, he reflects on his life's work as an activist and encourages all of us to stand up for what we think is right. The book is published by Hyperion, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome Congressman John Lewis back to our show. Hello.
Hello.
You say that there's a unique hostility in today's political climate that's almost worse than what you were up against in the 1960s. Worse than that?
It is unreal. It is unbelievable, the type of hostility that I see on the American political scene. The people that were so mean and vicious during the 60s, for the most part, they didn't have much power. They were not elected. They were members of the Klan, the White Citizen Council, and other groups. But here you have men and women in elected position that call the president all type of name. My mother would say that this president been called everything but a child of God. I don't know what it is. Is it something in the water that we drink? Is it something in the food we eat? Is it in the air that we breathe?
Is this just something that's happened during President Barack Obama's time in the White House, or did we hear similar things with Clinton and George Bush?
I think we heard some of the things during the days of President Clinton and then the days of President Bush, but it's so open, it's so overt, and I don't know what it is. Why are we so mean to each other? Can we just get along and be human and be civil?
Well, you say that the moral compass of many of today's politicians is skewed.
I think many of us have lost our way. And sometimes I feel like that maybe we should just conduct a massive nonviolent workshop and teach people the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence.
Is this something that is partisan, or are both parties guilty of it?
I think we all are guilty to some degree of forgetting that we are human, that we all live in the same house, that we are one people, that we are one family, that we can be better and do better, be kind. That's what the movement taught us.
You recently stood before Congress and argued that some of the gains you achieved in the civil rights movement, such as the Voting Rights Act, are in jeopardy now. How did you react when Republican Congressman Paul Brown proposed an amendment to the Voting Rights Act last week that would have taken away some of the Act's enforcement funds?
Well, I took to the floor and said, it is unbelievable, it is unreal, and especially someone from Georgia, you should know better. You should know better that in another period that people were denied the right to register to vote simply because of the color of their skin.
But he would argue, and others have argued, that the situation has changed and these funds are no longer necessary. The world has improved along those
well,
lines.
I would say that we have made progress. We made some improvement. But there is a systematic, deliberate attempt to take away some of these hard-won gains. There are people who want to take us back to another period. One member of Congress said we should bring the literacy test back. We cannot go back. We have to go forward. We need to open up the political process and let all of the people come in.
Do you agree with the claims that there's a political war on women going on right now?
Oh, I think there is a war on women. People want to take away the right of women to control their bodies. People want to deny women equal pay. That's not right.
Now, why do you think that is? I mean, it goes against a sense of fairness, and yet many people seem to think this is a good approach. Or at least we're hearing an awful lot of politicians who are saying similar things.
Well, people need to be – they just need to be educated and taught that women have rights. This is not the period when women were denied the right to register. You know, there's more women in America. There are more women voting. And one day, male politicians are going to wake up and know and realize they must also look out for women and not just white males.
And I've been reading in the paper about concern in the Republican Party about how some of the campaign rhetoric has alienated Hispanic voters since they are making up a growing portion of the voting public. How does a party deal with an awareness that what it stands for, whether you agree with it or not, is going to lose it votes?
Well, whether it's the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, we must be all inclusive. Hispanic, Asian American, Native American, women, the disabled, people of color, students, senior, no one must be left out or left behind. And that is an attempt to divide people.
Well, you say that the federal government was an advocate for the need to challenge injustice in the 1960s, but that's changed?
Well, the federal government during the 1960s was a sympathetic referee in the struggle for civil rights. We looked to the Supreme Court. Today, we cannot look to the Supreme Court.
You also decry the decline in decorum among politicians. Were you thinking about the time when Republican Congressman Joe Wilson called President Obama a liar during a joint session of Congress in 2009?
Well, I've thought about that a great deal. I don't know what is in another politician's heart or soul to refer to the President of the United States as a liar when he's delivering the State of the Union address. Anytime. If you don't respect a man, respect the office, respect the position.
But you've disagreed with some of the presidents who've been in office while you've been in Congress, and in some cases I'm sure you thought that they were lying about things.
I've disagreed with presidents. I disagree with other members of Congress. But I'm going to respect the dignity and the worth of every human being. I will not lower myself. It's not in keeping with the philosophy of nonviolence, with the idea of peace, with the concept of love.
Well, in the light of news last week that a super PAC was considering running a series of ads linking President Obama to the controversial former pastor, Reverend Jeremiah Wright, are you concerned about the tenor that this fall's election season will take on?
I'm deeply concerned about the tenor that this election could take on. I thought it was gutter politics.
Well, Mitt Romney distanced himself from it.
He distanced himself, but for a while he said, I have not read the paper. And then I guess after he got briefed or read the paper, he came around and distanced himself. And that was the right thing to do.
Was Cory Booker being disloyal when he criticized the president for his campaign's negative ads about Bain Capital?
Well, I think Cory Booker is... He's a wonderful young man, a wonderful politician, and he's a good friend. But he came back and tried to remove himself from that statement.
Like many politicians, he said something and then he said, it was out of context, or I didn't say it in the way I meant.
Well, sometimes we said we misspoken, and that's not really what I meant.
I love that word, misspoke.
Yeah.
Because it means, well, I really said something. I'm not saying that Cory Booker said something stupid, but whenever a politician says, oh, I misspoke, it means I said something stupid. I shouldn't have said it.
Well, I think we just should think and think hard and long sometime before we speak.
Well, do you think that Cory Booker had a point about the ads? He was complaining that the ads were negative.
Well, I didn't see anything wrong, and I don't see anything wrong with the ad just stating the obvious, stating facts.
Is it possible to win an election in the United States nowadays without going negative?
I think it's possible to win without being negative. We all grow. We make mistakes. We make blunders, but we learn.
My guest is John Lewis, United States Congressman. His latest book is called Across That Bridge. For whom did you write this book? Who do you hope will read it?
It is my hope that all Americans will read it.
Well, of course. So then it would be a major bestseller.
Well, I want everybody to read it. I want the young. I want our children, high school, middle school student. I want college. I want teachers. I want politicians. I want every one of my colleagues to read it. I want us to start talking about love. Some of us were beaten. I was beaten when I walked across that bridge. I left some blood on that bridge.
Oh, it was a lot worse than that.
But almost died on that bridge. But I never hated, and I will never hate.
And I wondered about that. It's almost a natural instinct to fight back when somebody is bashing in your skull. You just took it? I mean, you were that disciplined, that self-disciplined?
Well, we believed in a philosophy and a discipline of nonviolence. This book is telling you that we studied. We studied what Gandhi attempted to do in South Africa, what he accomplished in India. We studied passive resistance. We studied what Dr. King and Rosa Parks and other people were all about. So when we were beaten at the Greyhound bus station in Rock Hill, South Carolina, by a group of young men, the police officials came up and said, do you want to press charges? We said, no. We believe in love. We believe in peace.
In 2009, you received an apology from Elwin Wilson, a white Southerner who had brutally attacked you during a freedom ride in South Carolina in 1961. Were you surprised that he reached out to you?
I was surprised, but it was very much in keeping with the whole era of reconciliation. I was moved.
He's the only one who's ever done that.
Well, one person came up, not person that beat me, but a person in Birmingham, a white middle-aged man came up and said, John Lewis, I want to apologize to you on behalf of all of the white people of Alabama for what we did. But Wilson came up to me, hugged me, apologized, started crying. His son started crying. I started crying. And since then, I've seen him four different times. He called me brother, and I called him brother.
But that's almost that's a rarity, isn't it? There are so many, if anything, lines have hardened throughout this country. There have been many people who suggest that some of the attacks on President Obama, whether you agree with his policies or not, are racially motivated. Just again today, I received an email suggesting from some organization suggesting that the president was actually born in Kenya.
Well, there's so much hate and dislike in America. And it's not just President Obama, but we dislike people for different reasons. And sometimes I really wonder sometimes whether it is in the water we drink or in the food we eat or the air we breathe. I don't think it's in our DNA. What is it that make us come down on people because of their race, their color, a sexual orientation? Why? Can we move to a much higher level? I think we can be transformed to a much higher level.
Well, the NAACP just came out in support of the president's stand on same-sex marriage. But for a long time, there was a certain amount of tension between the civil rights movement and the gay rights movement. What do you think has changed?
Well, many of the leaders of the movement have come to that point, and many African-American politicians and others that have been active in the civil rights movement. Many, many years ago, I took the position. Dr. King took the position. Mrs. Coretta Scott King took the position before she died that there's not any room in our society for discriminating against someone because of sexual orientation. And some of us fought too long and too hard against discrimination based on race and color, not to stand up and speak up and speak out against discrimination based on sexual orientation. If two guys want to fall in love and get married, two women want to fall in love and get married, it's their business. You cannot build a wall when it comes to equality. It should be for everybody.
My guest is John Lewis, who's written a book called, and this is his latest book, Across That Bridge, Life Lessons and a Vision for Change. It has a foreword by Douglas Brinkley, and it is published by Hyperion. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Representative John Lewis, United States Congressman. His latest book, Across That Bridge, Life Lessons and Visions for Life Lessons and a Vision for Change. It's published by Hyperion. As a young boy, growing up in Alabama, you delivered sermons to the family's chickens?
Yes, as a little boy, I wanted to be a minister. I wanted to preach the gospel. But it was my responsibility to raise the chickens, and I fell in love with raising chickens like no one else could raise chickens. And from time to time, with the help of my brothers and sisters and cousins, we would gather all of our chickens together in the chicken yard. And my cousins and brothers and sisters would line the outside of the chicken yard, but they helped make up the audience, the congregation. And I would start speaking or preaching, and when I look back on it, some of these chickens would bow their heads, some of these chickens would shake their heads. They never quite said amen, but I'm convinced that some of those chickens that I preached to during the 40s and the 50s tended to listen to me much better than some of my colleagues listened to me today in the Congress. And some of those chickens were just a little more productive. At least they produce eggs.
You said, say amen, say it again, and they never responded. But they did probably cluck a bit.
They did cluck. They made a little noise. And I tell young people today, I said, you need to make a little noise. During the 60s, we made a little noise. We got in the way. We stood up.
So why do you think Americans were unhappy in the 60s, but they seem to be unhappy with the status quo again today, but in a different way?
Well, they need to find a way to get in the way. They need to study like we did. Before we would participate in the inner sit-in, going in a march, or standing at a theater, before we went on the Freedom Ride, we studied. We prepared ourselves, and we were ready.
How old were you when the Brown versus Board of Education decision was held?
When that decision
handed down in 1954.
In 1954, I was only 14 years old, but I remember that decision. I thought the next year came down May 17, 1954. I thought the next school year, September, I would be attending a desegregated school. It never happened for me. Never.
Even college?
In college, I went to an all-African-American college, but had white professors. But that decision, along with Rosa Parks, the murder of Emmett Till, I remember that in 1955, August 28, 1955. I thought it could be any young African-American. But the action of Rosa Parks and the leadership of Dr. King inspired me to do something, to get involved.
But it was important for it to be nonviolent. In fact, the key word, it seems to me, in Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee is the word nonviolent. Student Coordinating Committee could mean anything.
You're right. The key word, nonviolent. It was the way to organize, the way to live. It was the way to get things done.
But there were other people, I'm sure, who were saying to you, you know, John, it's never going to – that's not the right way. You got to offer some resistance.
Oh, I remember a discussion that I had with the late Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall when we came off the Freedom Ride in May of 1961. It was in Nashville at Fisk University, and we had just got out of jail in Mississippi.
Was that the Parchman Farm?
Yeah, that's where I stayed.
Scariest prison
place
in America.
In America, probably one of the scariest prisons in the world. I will never, ever forget that. It's about this time of year.
So you were talking to Thurgood Marshall?
And Mr. Marshall said, John, it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense for you all to continue to get on those buses and trains and go to Jackson, Mississippi, and get arrested and go to jail. Just let us take one case to the United States Supreme Court. And I said, Mr. Marshall, we're in the process of organizing a mass movement. So everybody will have an opportunity to participate.
And then there was the March on Washington, 1963, and that opened a lot of eyes because so many people showed up.
That was a wonderful experience. More than 250,000 people participated in the march.
And although you were just 23 years old, you delivered one of the keynote addresses at the march. But didn't you have to edit your remarks at the last minute?
Well, some people thought that my speech was a little too strong. They thought it was a little too militant. It was not. It was insistent. It was persistent. I was speaking for the people that we were working with, really in the heart of the Deep South. in the Black Belt of Alabama, in the Delta, Mississippi, in Southwest Georgia. And I was saying, in effect, that we must have change, and we must have it now.
But you did leave in some criticisms of the Kennedy administration.
Well,
many people considered them to have been strong supporters of the civil rights movement.
But President Kennedy, along with his brother Robert Kennedy and wonderful others in the administration, especially in the Department of Justice, became very strong allies of the civil rights movement. I admired President Kennedy. I loved him.
But he had to be pulled into the fray.
We had to encourage him. And he changed. He grew. And Robert Kennedy became convinced that the movement was the place that he had to stand up and be supportive of.
You called patience a dirty and nasty word in that speech. Yet in your book, you devote a whole chapter to the virtue of patience in activism. Has serving in Congress changed your mind about how long it can take for any meaningful change to be achieved?
Well, during the March on Washington, in that speech, I said something like, you tell us to wait. You tell us to be patient. We cannot be patient. We want our freedom, and we want it now. A lot of that was rhetoric during the summer of 1963. But the movement taught me to take the hard look, the long look, that our struggle is not just a struggle for a few days, a few weeks, a few months, a few years. It is a struggle of a lifetime, or maybe many lifetimes.
Somebody just talked in my ear, so I got a little confused here. But there were a lot of people who weren't all that patient. We saw the development of the Black Power movement, the Black Panthers. Do you think that they played a significant role?
I think we had individuals that used what they thought was the right way. I happen to believe at that time, and I still believe today, that if you want meaningful and lasting changes, the way must be the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence. If you want to create the beloved community, your means, your methods must be one of love and peace.
Well, how far do you want to extend this? You say that Martin Luther King's greatest speech was an anti-war talk that he delivered in New York City in 1967, not one of his great civil rights speeches. And you devote a great deal of the book to discussing the futility of war. Do you think war is ever justified? Many people will say, well, how do you explain World War II? Wasn't that a war that was justified?
Well, I hate war. War is bloody. War is messy. War destroyed the hopes and dreams and aspirations of a people. If I had been of age during World War II, I don't know what I would have done. I've gone and visited the Holocaust Museum in Washington, outside of Chicago, I've gone to Germany and other places in Europe. And I still, to this day, raise the question, how did the world stand by and let this happen? It must never, ever happen again.
But you're saying that it should have been ended before it became a war.
There should have been efforts to negotiate and to destroy the will of people to engage in violence.
Well, do you think the United States was wrong to use force to overthrow the Taliban in the wake of the September 11th attacks?
Well, I would have preferred for us to try to do what we could to negotiate, to mediate. But at the same time, I, for one, and sometimes my conscience call upon me to say why, I cannot believe what happened on September 11. That must never happen again. When I came and saw the sight, I broke down and cried.
Do you support the hunting down of people connected with it, the assassination of Osama bin Laden, the way it was conducted, or some of the people who are calling for jihad today?
I don't like murder. I don't like seeing anybody killed, because anytime someone is murdered or destroyed, it tend to destroy all of us.
Now, the world loves to play the game of what if. You were originally a supporter of Hillary Clinton, then you switched over to Barack Obama, and people have often asked, well, what would have happened if Hillary Clinton had gone on to get the nomination and then become president? Do you think the world would look all that different today?
I don't think the world would look that different. Senator Clinton and, at that time, Senator Barack Obama was not that far apart. But I thought about it, and I had an executive session with myself. I love Hillary Clinton. I love Bill Clinton. They've been wonderful friends of mine. But I saw Mr. Obama as being part of what we have been struggling for. And maybe, just maybe one day, in the not-too-distant future, Hillary Clinton will have another opportunity to run for president. If she did decide, have the desire to run, I would be there with her.
Meanwhile, she's Secretary of State, one of the most important positions in the American political system.
She's doing an unbelievable job, and she works so hard.
We don't have a lot of time left, but I am curious about your responses to the Tea Party movement and the Occupy movement.
I see the Occupy movement as part of an effort to say to America, you got to look out not just for the 1%, but also the 99%. These are people who are saying we must find a way to humanize industry and humanize our government. Make it a little more human.
Well, we are now seeing a situation, despite the latest thing with J.P. Morgan Chase, the people are still calling for deregulation. Paul Krugman writes an op-ed column saying that would be a terrible mistake. Others think that we are really the government is at war with American the financial system and American industry. How do we work that out?
Well, I think people in business and those of us in government and American people must use our best talents, our best minds to find a way to accommodate and work things out and look out for all America and not just for a small percentage of America.
And why do you think the Tea Party, which includes a lot of people who do not have a lot of money, why do you think that they take the position?
I don't understand it. I don't understand the Tea Party. I don't understand why people vote against their best interest and not looking out for themselves. They should be part of the Occupy movement. They should be interested in taking care of basic human needs.
So if you had a magic wand, what would you most like to see change in our country in the next decade or two?
If I was a benevolent dictator and had a wand, I would put everybody to work.
Well, how do you do that?
Create jobs. I would spend millions and billions on a public work program, repairing our infrastructure, educating all of our children, and feeding people.
Well, we've seen the president propose a modest version of that, and governors of a number of states saying, I don't want your money.
Well, those
Congress saying, we don't want to give you the money.
Well, the governors that and the states that don't want the money, give it to the states that need it and want it.
Well, if you're going to have a high-speed rail, you got to go through all the states. That's the problem, unfortunately. John Lewis's latest book is called Across That Bridge, Life Lessons and a Vision for Change. It's published by Hyperion. And, Congressman, it's always a pleasure to have you on our show.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure and a delight to be with you.